big problem is that the more general you are, the more impossible it becomes to standardize value creation. And that's the big advantage of niching down. So you have to productize it.
Welcome to The Game, where we talk about how to get more customers, how to make more per customer, and how to keep them longer, and the many failures and lessons we have learned along the way. I hope you enjoy and subscribe.
So, man, in your opinion, what are the three most powerful skills that someone should develop if they want to make a lot of money?
I mean, the three core skills are you got to learn how to build, you got to learn how to sell, and you got to learn how to lead.
Just like that. There we are. In terms of maybe like hard skills that someone should really focus on learning to develop, like sales, copywriting, leadership, what would you say are the most important?
Well, those are the three big buckets, right? So it's like one is that like leadership is just the internal bucket of getting people to do what you want them to do at scale, right? And then from a selling perspective, I include that in all things that are marketing, letting people know about your stuff, promotion, and actually converting people into customers. And then the third piece of building product and services is so that at scale, if the product is good enough, then you won't lose customers. And if it's exceptional, the product itself will get you more customers. And so most businesses taken to their natural extreme on a promotional level typically are leaky buckets because the product actually sucks. And most businesses suck in general because most products aren't good and most people want to cancel very quickly and don't want to continue to use them, which is why very good companies are very rare. Most of them generally are mediocre or not good. And so I prefer to solve a business from back to front, which is like, can we find something that people actually like and want to continue to use and continue to pay for? And then the marketing is almost a commoditized skill. Like it's very easy to let other people know about your stuff and do so louder and louder and louder, provided the product is good. And then the internal has to get run with a leader that can attract the talent to continue to do this, because quickly the business will bottleneck based on the founder and their expertise, or usually they have a niche that might be product people, they might be tech people, they might be finance people, they might be whatever. And then they have to be of the character to attract the talent that will allow them to get to nine figures or whatever it is that the goal is.
Yeah, 100%. Let's say my only goal was just to get rich AF.
What is rich AF, just so we define it?
100 million. Why not? Okay. It's a good number.
Cool.
You're willing to work hard, but you have limited skills and experience. What business would you start right now?
And I have no money, right?
Very limited.
Yeah.
Maybe a couple thousand.
Yeah. So then I would probably build a boring business in services. And I would probably pick something around the body. Like, you know, if I wouldn't start a design firm, because I think that has a high likelihood of getting disrupted in some way by AI. As silly as this sounds, like a nail salon or a lawn care service. I mean, especially body ones. Dentist stuff, like you still have to go in and get your teeth taken care of. And many times people value the human exchange more than something robotic. So for example, in the fitness world, this is my data point around this. There was a brand called CocoFit. They struggled a ton and then eventually went out of business because they tried to automate personal training. So they created these all-in-one machines that you'd have a key fob and it would count your reps. And every time you went to the machine, it would say how to do more and what weight you did last time. It's a really cool concept. The problem was their theory was that the reason that people weren't getting results is that they didn't know what to do, when the reality is that no one was showing up at the gym. And so people hire personal trainers because they want another human to talk to and to hold them accountable to showing up. Same reason, like if you had a robot cutting hair, there might be a percentage of the population that do it, but a lot of women like the going to the hair salon and having that exchange. And so I would probably build a business around services in general would be my way. And then I would continue to scale that. And you could do that at a local chain level and you can make a lot of money doing that. Or you could do it at a national level, which would be like professional services.
Yeah, 100%. I love the idea behind the core stuff that's going to be here forever, you know? Yeah, really cool, man. So dude, this was an interesting one. Like, obviously, I know you can't go back and split test life. And obviously, you have achieved quite enormous success. So things ended up working out.
Yeah.
But let's say hypothetically, the great fires of Las Vegas burn everything to the ground. You lost everything. You had to start again. What would you say is the number one thing that you would have done differently to get to where you are now?
And I have no reputation, right?
Yeah, no reputation.
It burns my reputation on the ground with it. So I actually have lost everything before. And so I know what I did and I probably would have done the same thing. So the easiest way that I did to like go make 100 grand in a month when I had nothing was that I would go find a business that was local, that I understood, and that I could sell something expensive for. I would front the capital to market I would work the leads and I would sit at the front desk and sell, and I would negotiate what they would be willing to do, a big bulk of services. I wanted to find a chiropractor, and I'd say, hey, if I sent you 100 customers this month, what's the lowest rate you would do all 100 customers for this level of service? And then I would just negotiate that down, and then I would spend as much as I could and sell it for as much as I can so I can make the spread. And then they would service the customers. And for them, it's a zero risk offer because they don't have to do anything. I front everything else. And then for me, I don't have to do anything but market and sell, and I can take all of that. And so like when I lost everything, I immediately was able to make 100 grand the next month by doing that playbook.
Mm. Dude, your story is crazy. Like there's no amount of times you can tell me, and I still want to hear it every time. It's so inspiring. It's insane. Yeah, really cool, man. So that was kind of like the high level stuff. I want to ask three rapid fire, like more granular tactical questions on ads specifically. So switching gears for a second, what would you say is the best lead nurturing process to take people from paid ad to booked call in your experience?
Real talk, brand, but like actually, but what I can tell you is that from all the portfolio companies that we have, there's no silver bullets. It's a lot of golden BBs. It's basically doing the fundamentals at scale. So all the things that you know you should be doing but aren't doing, just actually doing all of those things tends to be the thing that works best, which is contacting the leads immediately, following up multiple times per day, personalizing the messages to the person, having some sort of open loop between first call and second call, something that you can provide value to in a very real way. That's where I like having, I think I talk about this in the book, like having services that people actually know have value, like a real value, not just like ascribed value. And saying I can complete the second half of this on our next call, it just gives people a very strong reason to show up for that. And you get some reciprocity before you go for a close or whatever. And so I like thinking about like each of those little check marks and saying, can I make sure we're actually doing this at scale? I will share this with your audience. Like having now gotten one company to 10 million a month and the portfolio significantly higher than that, advanced people just do the basics at scale. Like there is nothing, there is no, like the scale brings the complexity. It's not novel things. It's just, what does it look like when you service clients one-on-one? Everyone's like, it's so easy to service clients one-on-one, right? Because it's just you and you over-deliver and you do a great job, right? It's like, so just standardize what that looks like and actually getting good people to do that too 100 times over is what advanced looks like. But there's not a lot of new stuff. It's just actually making sure that it gets done, which becomes all about operational constraints more than anything else.
Yeah. One of my favorite lines in the book, and that I've heard you say a lot, is the advanced people never don't do the basics. And I think it's really easy to forget the basic stuff as you start to scale up because you feel like you've outgrown it. But in reality, you really just need to keep doing it over and over again.
You don't outgrow fundamentals.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. I've made that mistake many times. Cool. So, man, what would you say are some of your best practices for maximizing show-up rates for calls booked, especially from cold traffic?
So we had Allen, which was our lead nurture software. And so we had 4,000 plus appointments a day. And so I have a decent amount of data to provide on show up rates. So the number one factor, which no one knows for show up rates, is the amount of time slots available per day. So across all factors, being available for more times, more total hours, and more actual slots creates more total throughput and having more days per week open. Because what happens is, like, if someone can't find the ideal time, they take a less ideal time. And it's a less ideal time, so they have a lower likelihood of showing up, right? And so the idea is it's completely reversed from this whole idea of, like, show a partially filled calendar. Like, it's complete horseshit. Like, just give as many times as you possibly can, and people will pick the time that's most convenient for them. We did notice that, at least in the huge amount of data that we looked at across all appointments, up to 5 days was okay. That was surprising to me. I would have expected it to be shorter than that, but that was actually what it looked like. Now, one of the downsides of providing so many time slots is that you will have a higher percentage of people, if you're just talking about throughput, show, but you might have a lower show rate. So you talk about the entire funnel, you get a higher percentage to book. And even if it's further out, like if you're just looking at how many clicks did I get and how many showed appointments did I get, then you have to play the interplay of my salesman's calendar, right? Because I might have to have more sales guys that have fewer people show up, but I get more total show ups. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I definitely used to subscribe to the partially shown calendar kind of thing for scarcity, but I've realized that what you said is true.
More convenience. So that is the single greatest thing. The rest of it is personalization, volume of reach outs, speed of reach out, and availability. So those are the four core nurture pillars. So what's the availability in terms of days per week and hours per day and number of time slots available per day? So there's the three functions for availability. For volume of reach out, It's how many times am I reaching out per day and how many days am I doing the follow-up? The speed of contact at the initial and speed between contacts, meaning if I reach out to somebody within 5 minutes, cool. But if they text me back 5 hours later, am I immediately texting them back at that point too? So speed of first reach out and speed of response. And then you have the fourth pillar, which I forgot and I named 2 seconds ago.
Yeah.
Personalization. So it's personalization, which comes down to communicating with them on the channel that they prefer. And so some people prefer messaging on Facebook Messenger. Some people prefer phone calls. Some people prefer email. Some people prefer SMS. And it's basically blasting all four. And then the one that they respond on is the one you stay on, because that's the one that they've shown that they prefer. It's like, I will never respond to email. I don't care. Ever. But I do respond to text. I rarely respond to DMs, but like if I were to rank these things. And so if someone can text me, then that's the highest likelihood response channel for me.
There you go. So if anyone wants to get in contact with Alex, now you know how.
Magically find my number.
Cool. I got 2 questions on lifestyle, and then I want to jam on some AI stuff, and then we'll bring the other guys in. So you mentioned on a podcast with Tom Bilyeu that you don't have rules. So
yeah.
I, for example, quite often end up working up until midnight, 2 a.m., 3 a.m., and basically fucking up my sleep schedule because I have too much freedom, right? Because I'm self-employed. So how do you kind of strike that balance between freedom and discipline, you know, if you're driven and you want to accomplish big things?
I think it's a micro macro look. Like it's kind of 80-20. Like if you know that when you stay up late, like there are times when I will gas it and go past my red line in terms of work. And I know that I'm eating into tomorrow. But if I'm like in a flow and I'm crushing it and the muse shows up and the muse wants to work, then I work. You know what I mean? But if there's some days on the flip side where I wake up and I just feel foggy as shit and I just like, for whatever reason, I ate too much Mexican last night and I don't have it that day, then I might call it earlier. Like the idea of me pushing through and punishing when it comes to the type of work I do. Now, if I were doing a more brute force work, then I would care less. You know what I mean? If it was just like, if I was doing reach outs, I was doing cold calls, I was training, personal training sessions, I was cutting hair, I'm just going to brute force my way through it because I don't need to have higher brain function. And that's not an insult. I'm just saying like, you're not like thinking of creative things. You know what I mean? You're working the work. But when it comes to like writing or making presentations or communication of some sort, it's more, I try and optimize around how can I maximize over a week, how much flow state I can be in so I can just get the most total quality output.
Yeah.
So it's not about rules. It's more like which of these things has the highest likelihood of getting me the most.
Mosey Nation, real quick, if you are a business owner that has a big old business and wants to get to a much bigger business, going to $50, $100 million plus, we would love to talk to you. And if you like that or would like to hear more about it, go to acquisition.com. You can apply anywhere on the page and talk to one of our team and see if we can help you get there.
Definitely super helpful. Switching gears for a sec to fitness. You don't have to answer this one if you're not comfortable, but it is probably the number one question that I got. Everyone. So I'm just going to read it word for word. So this guy says, Alex, you look like Hercules if you ate a tank. Obviously, your diet and your workouts are on point, but yeah. I still haven't been able to achieve a physique like that in over a decade of training. And many fitness influencers are on gear and lie about it, which is super demotivating because they're selling unrealistic expectations. Yeah. I wish more people would be honest because I don't see anything wrong with juicing at all. And I don't know why there's such a stigma around it. So I just wanted to know, have you taken any performance enhancements or do you just have goat genetics? Huge respect either way, you're an idol.
Yeah, I'll answer. I'll give the answer in a second, but I want to address the thing that I think matters more here, which is why does it matter? Because let's say that everybody's not on steroids, just for a hypothetical sake. Okay, well, what's the next thing you move to? Well, they all have better genetics than me. Okay, great. You're right. Congratulations. You'll never achieve what you want. Now what? Okay. Well, what are you going to do? Well, you probably still need to train harder to use whatever genetics you got. You probably need to eat better, no matter what genetics you got, to get more out of what you have. And so like whether someone else is on gear or not changes nothing. Because even if they weren't on gear, I might have goat genetics and you might not, which then becomes the new thing that you get to blame. And so, and I say this with love, and I knew that I saw the message they sent to me earlier. I know that this was out of love, but I say this like very genuinely, like control the controllables. Like what difference in your behavior does me being on gear or not being on gear or having goat genetics or not having goat genetics, what does that change about your behavior? Why would you allow it to change your behavior? And so at the end of the day, if you want to get jacked, then you do the maximum amount of things that jacked people do. Now, I don't know how hard you train. There's plenty of guys I know who've been training for a decade that look the same. I also see them in the gym. They don't train that hard, right? Mm-hmm. If you've ever trained with an IFBB pro, right? If you've trained with people who compete in fitness, they'll probably expose you to a much higher level of training, right? Like if you're like, well, I've been, you know, I try to eat well. Well, I would ask this question when I had fitness clients. I would say, okay, did you follow the meal plan? They would always say yes. And I'd say, okay, let me ask it differently. 7 days a week, you had 3 meals a day that you were supposed to eat and 2 shakes, right? This is what I would make for Gen Pop. It's not like an espouse. I'm just big disclaimer. Say of those 7 days a week, so 3 meals, 2 shakes, 7 days a week, how many days were you perfect on that? And they'd be like, oh, I mean, at least 4. And I'd be like, right. So I asked you, did you follow it? You said yes. And then I asked you, did you follow it more specifically? And you said no. In 1 day, you can fuck up your entire diet. It's not that hard. You have a 500 calorie day surplus, and then 1 day you eat 2,000 extra, you break even, right? And then you're surprised that you're not looking different. And so like, remember, I came from this world. So like, I have more charge around it because I've had thousands of client conversations around weight loss and fitness stuff. But no, so I'm on TRT now. I've been on TRT since I was 28. I also had state records before I went on TRT, and I was 235 pounds. And Muscle and Fitness wrote an article about me being natural when I was natural. And so I am no longer pure natty. I'm on TRT. I take 75 milligrams a week. And that's what I do.
Yeah. I mean, it's low dosage anyway. So there we go. For the record, for everyone's asking.
Yeah. And when they tested it, I think on TRT, I think my testosterone was like 900.
Boom.
So there you go. Now, the thing is just now, what do you do with that?
Yeah, exactly right.
Like, now what do you do with that? It just doesn't change.
I'm curious.
Yeah, no, I know. I say this out of love for every, like, for the person in the audience who asked that question. I say that out of love because it's, what does it change about your behavior? Nothing. And I was jacked as shit before this when I was 235 pounds, which is bigger than I am now when I was natural. I trained harder and I ate more. Mm.
The fundamentals.
Yeah.
Yeah. Killer. One quick question about AI, and then I've got some guests that I want to bring on quickly. So. Yeah. Just curious to hear your thoughts on the future of AI, specifically as it pertains to like the digital marketing industry and copywriting, as that's what my audience does, right? So short to midterm, I always see AI as an advantage for copywriters, right? It's a tool that can help us with our output, idea generation, pump out first drafts a lot faster. But long term, let's say we do get to the stage where AI is able to write an entire book, build the whole sales funnel, write all the ads, film all the ads, publish everything, done within an hour, right? What do you think happens to copywriters? Do you think the role of copywriter transitions more into like prompt engineer, marketing engineer, or should we all just pivot and run for the hills?
Yeah, so I have thought about this a lot. And so I think that you just have to take things to the natural extreme, which is when AI and robots can do everything that a human can do better than a human can do, then money won't matter. And so then it will be irrelevant. And then it will be purely based on what percentage of people have access to the smartest AI. And then who governs, who has access to that. So we'll get to a society, in my opinion, taken to its natural extreme, where money will be irrelevant and there will have to just become a new system. Now, I don't know what that system is, but that's what would happen. Now, until that happens, we don't have a ton to worry about as far as like, what will I change about my behavior tomorrow with knowing this, right? Well, there's always going to be arbitrage between people who know how to do something and people who don't. So people are like, oh my God, like copywriting AI. It's like, do you know how many small business owners don't even know what ChatGPT is? Zillions. And even if they did, that they don't know how to recognize good copy. And so like right now, ChatGPT writes code. Guess what I don't know how to do? Write code. Guess what else I also don't know how to do? See if the code it wrote was good. I don't know. And so what ends up happening, in my opinion, at least in the short term, is that you can get a 10x increase in productivity because you can write at such a faster rate of code or copy or whatever, because you have the perspective to make a judgment on how good it is. Right. And you can make adjustments and you can tweak the prompts and all that other stuff. And so short term, it's going to be people who know how to leverage AI to get more out of what they do. Long term, nothing's going to matter anyways. And so I think that sounds like an eventuality, but what is that going to affect about today? Not a lot. And just like any technology, use it to your own advantage.
Mm. Do you think that we're going to reach a point of UBI where humans have effectively been replaced by AI? And then if so, then like what role do you think like humans will play if there's no need for us? You know what I mean?
I would say it's above my pay grade, but I will continue to keep active. And I will say this other thing that might help the audience, which is like, if you're a competitive person, then you're going to have access to the same resources everyone else does. And as long as you are the type of person who continues to compete and continues to go above average, it's still you. Like, realistically, you're not competing against AI. You're competing against humans. And so, just like always, there's going to be resources, there's going to be tools, then some will wield them better than others. And so you're still competing against people until eventually you're only competing against machines, in which case all bets are off. And so until that point, the only controllable I have is to get better and to continue to compete.
Well, we'll see what happens when we come to that bridge. Cool, man. That's been really, really helpful. I just want to bring AJ on for a second. He's got a question about business and dating.
Ah.
Yeah.
Spicy topic. Like Alex would have shown. Thanks for hosting this. And Alex is a lot of folks here. So my question is actually inspired. Alex put a video on Eye of the Tiger. Really yes. Strong video. And the train of thought of going all in. My question is, how do you juggle business and dating when you were single? I know you mentioned previously, you know, we did it when you're a millionaire, did it when you're broke. It's a human need, right? So I'm curious what the nuances here. I feel it's always been a cycle of focus and it goes well, dating goes to shit. Do you have any frameworks and advice around structuring dating?
Yeah. I would say there's seasons, and I think you just got to give yourself grace around it. You know what I mean? Like, if there were seasons where I wasn't actively looking for anyone and people just walked into my life, and there are seasons where, like, when I had my gyms, I had customers walking in every day. They knew people. Like, I had more surface area of luck in terms of exposure of meeting people. Once I went to multiple locations, I was actually at my house all the time trying to manage all locations. I didn't really go to the locations as much, especially during like customer hours. And so then I had way fewer like exposure to girls. And so then I got on the apps and started going on dates and stuff. And so for me, I just made it work that during my lunch break was when I would, swipe and do my calls, because I just worked at like leads. And so I would just have the same 2 to 3 exchanges and then immediately say, hey, can I just give you a call? I'm on my way to lunch. We'll learn more about each other in a 10-minute phone call than we will on 5 days of texting. And 4 out of 5 times they would say, sure. Thank God. Somebody's actually taking control, blah, 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 blah. I'd hop on the phone, ask them, set script, like, what's your goal right now? You know, label them with a problem over their past experiences. And then, you know, open loop. Okay, cool. Well, that sounds interesting. Sounds like our goals are aligned. I think might be able to help you out. You know, how about we talk about this over drinks or whatever? And then if it just sounded like not a good date or person, I would just not do it. And so my biggest, you know, hack was just how many dates I said no to after a 5 or 10 minute call rather than wasting 2 hours.
Paid in full.
Yeah. But that week I did my first app date ever. And I had a girl that I met and I was like, oh, you are horrible. I just wish I could just disappear. I never want to talk to you again. And then I was like, I will never not have a conversation with somebody over the phone prior to a date. And so that's how I did it from that point on.
Love that. One last question, super quick. I'm sorry, Stephen Blaz, but James, bring us home.
Yo, can you hear me?
Yep, shoot.
Alec, lovely to meet you. Massive inspiration. Love the event. Love the book. My question is, I have a e-commerce coaching company for beginners, and I'm in the process of doing the research right now. I think I actually have a record-breaking for our industry success rate. So I'm growing that extremely quickly just on word of mouth and funnels alone. But my question for you is, the company is growing mainly because of me speaking and doing ads and funnels. I'm the face of it. That said, when I get to a point where, say, around 1 million a month, I want to be in a position where I can create leaders for it. Other people in America, Europe, who become their own face like me for the company to help it grow that way, kind of like you did with Gym Launch. I was wondering what the process is to create leaders like that to grow a company.
Okay, I'm going to give you 3 directions. So direction 1 is you can scale via events as a big part of your delivery. So if you look at the biggest kind of education businesses that are in the space, so talking like 9-figure businesses, almost exclusively use events because scaling coaching teams is very difficult. So that's number 1. Okay. Number 2, like Gym Launch is obviously a very big company. What we did was because we were hyper niched, we could productize almost every part of the service. And so that allowed me to take people who wouldn't otherwise be you or me or my face or whatever and still deliver the same level of value. That's the big problem, is that the more general you are, the more impossible it becomes to standardize value creation. And that's the big advantage of niching down. So you have to productize it. The third kind of bucket here that you can do, or like the consideration, is that you can then bring people on if you think they are exceptional and basically have people who run P&Ls of kind of departments. Right. So for example, at Gym Launch, we had an agency service, which was part of what we did for gyms. And so you can have someone who is in charge of that department, but it basically runs as a separate company. Now it's under the umbrella and you cross sell and all that kind of stuff, but you really bring a leader in who's exceptional and they get compensated off the P&L of that micro business. And so like, if you look at Jeff Bezos with Amazon, Amazon is barely even a company. It's just a conglomeration of many, 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 many businesses. And so he even calls his CEOs, that's what he calls them, even though they're just employees, but they still run their own books. They run their own profit and loss statements. And that way you can incentivize them like owners. And so the key is to translate your question. It's like, how do I get people to act like owners in a business that they don't own?
Genius.
And so the answer is that you try and get as close to ownership compensation, at least in the manner that you attract them and compensate them as possible.
Got it. Thank you so much. I'll look into those.
All right. Appreciate you. Thank you, guys.